Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. So today I want to focus my opening remarks to get this started on war and militarism. And Gaza and Ukraine are just the tip of the iceberg about what's going on in the world today. But let's start with them. Gaza, you know, the genocidal atrocities continue without interruption. And we've had this temporary ceasefire, prisoner exchange, and humanitarian aid proposal from the US, the UK, Egypt, and Qatar. But both Israel and Hamas have so far not agreed to it. And whether or not that temporary ceasefire is accepted, Netanyahu says Israel still plans to invade Rafah sooner or later. There are about 1.5 million Gazans who are refugees camped out in Rafah, and a ground invasion there is just going to lead to catastrophic mass casualties. In fact, Israel's already conducting deadly airstrikes and targeted ground operations in Rafah. And it also looks like, well, for one thing, the violence in the West Bank under the cover of the war in Gaza continues as settlers keep attacking Palestinians and their settlements or their villages. The settlements are what the Israelis are putting in the place of Palestinian villages. That's going on. And it also looks like with the beginning of Ramadan in about a week on March 10th, a whole new conflict and violence is being set up at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Temple Mount compound in Jerusalem, where, you know, religious people and including, you know, fanatics and extremists on both sides are planning to flood the site. And Israeli military forces will be there. And they have invaded and arrested worshipers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque many times before. And they're planning to be there and intervene again. So it's just going from bad to worse. And meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinians are dying right now, not so much from bombs and bullets as from hunger and disease, for the lack of food and medicine due to the Israeli blockade. The U.S. is calling for a temporary ceasefire, but it, at the same time, is still supplying weapons and diplomatic cover to Israel, including that U.N. Security Council veto a couple of weeks ago against a ceasefire resolution. And just this Thursday, it vetoed another UN Security Council expressing deep concern over the Israeli military's killing of Gazans seeking food aid earlier on Thursday. You probably heard about that. You know, gunfire was definitely heard on videos we've seen. The reports in the hospitals and aid stations is lots of gunshot wounds and death from gunshot, and that's the Israelis, the Israeli forces in there. The U.S., on the positive side, is going to start airdropping aid into Gaza, but the overall hypocrisy of the U.S. government is there for the whole world to see, and it's harming U.S. relations with the whole world and alienating the progressive voter base for Biden. But Biden's blind loyalty to Israel is sabotaging his reelection and opening the door for the would-be dictator Donald Trump, who's even worse on the Israeli question, if that's possible. And think about this. The Biden administration says it wants a Palestinian government acceptable to Israel when it talks about the two-state solution. You've heard that. But it never says it wants an Israeli government that is acceptable to the Palestinians. Mustafa Barghouti made that point this week, a couple days ago, in the Intercept's podcast called Intercepted. And we'll put the link to that in the chat. Mustafa Barghouti is the head of the Palestinian National Initiative, which is a left-wing secular Palestinian party with a nonviolent strategy for Palestinian liberation. It's an alternative to the autocratic corruption of Fatah and the PLO and running the Palestinian Authority, and also the fundamentalist authoritarianism of Hamas. And public opinion polls in both the West Bank and Gaza before October 7th. They haven't been able to get too many polls since then, but showed that the majority of Palestinians want an alternative to the corruption of the Palestinian Authority and the fundamentalism of Hamas. And that was shown in the recent municipal elections in the West Bank, where 80% of those elected were independents. They weren't with Hamas, they weren't with Fatah. So there's a yearning for an alternative. Mustafa Barghouti is a good representative of that. His Palestinian National Initiative was supported by the late Edward Said when it formed in the early 2000s. And Barghouti came in second in the last Palestinian presidential election in 2005. So what really struck me is Barghouti also noted in that podcast that the Palestinian National Initiative is contacted and has discussions with governments from across the Arab world and Europe, but never the United States. And that says a lot to me. The U.S. is sidelining the secular, nonviolent, democratic political force in Palestine in favor of the corrupt, autocratic, and collaborationist Fatah party that leads the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. So they don't really want a Palestinian government that is a real advocate for the Palestinian people. They want a corrupted, compromised Palestinian state that they can control. So the hypocrisy between U.S. government rhetoric in support of democracy and U.S. practice in Israel and Palestine is just disgusting. And so we put that link in to the interview with Mustafa Barghouti. I recommend it. It's about 40, 45 minutes. And so what we need to see and demand is action, not just words from the U.S. government. Today, there are over 200 demonstrations across the U.S. and there are more around the world demanding hands off Rafah, a permanent ceasefire now, an end to the blockade of Gaza so the food and medicine can get in, freedom for all prisoners, an exchange of prisoners and hostages between Hamas and Israel, and an end to all U.S. military aid to Israel. And we need to be out there in these demonstrations. Maybe some of you have already gone today or you're going, and I hope everybody will take every opportunity because I think they do make a difference. But we also need to be flooding the president and Congress with messages insisting that the U.S. stop funding and supporting and giving diplomatic cover to Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza. And I think, we've moved some of the language in the administration. Now we got to move the action. And meanwhile, in Ukraine, a congressional minority of far-right Republicans are holding Congress hostage in order to block military aid to Ukraine. And Ukraine right now is facing catastrophic shortages of artillery rounds and air defense missiles, which they need to hold back the new Russian offensives that are taking more Ukrainian territory. Putin's State of the Union speech a couple days ago made clear that Russia's goals in Ukraine are still the same: regime change to install a puppet regime and destroy Ukrainian identity. The latter is a crime of genocide under the 1948 Genocide Convention, to which Russia is party. And Putin also made nuclear threats again. Yet the House leader, Mike Johnson, refuses to bring the Ukrainian aid to the floor. It would pass if it were put to a vote, because all the Democrats support Ukraine aid and a lot of Republicans do as well. But a far-right minority in the House is vetoing what the majority in both the House and the Senate want and what the majority of the American people want, if you look at the polls. So what this bill provides for is $95.3 billion in supplemental foreign aid. $60 billion is for Ukraine, $14 billion is for military aid to Israel, $5 billion is in military aid to Taiwan and other Indo-Pacific countries, $9 billion is for humanitarian assistance in many places around the world, but including Gaza. Now, some Democrats are talking about using a discharge petition to force a vote, and others, or some of the same ones, are talking about separating the Ukraine aid from the Israeli aid because progressives want to vote for the Ukraine aid, but not the Israeli aid. But it will take at least 5 or 6 weeks for that discharge petition process to be completed. The discharge petition would require 218 House members. The House makeup now is 219 Republicans and 213 Democrats. So they would need at least 3 Republicans if all the members vote and the Democrats hold. But some of them are not going to support it because of the Israeli aid if they're combined. So that means, you know, they're going to have to get more than 3 Republicans to support a discharge petition, which is hard. It's a very rarely used parliamentary mechanism. And it takes time. It requires 30 legislative days. So it doesn't count the many days when the House is on their long weekend breaks and longer vacations. And unless it's attached to another bill, it has to wait those 30 legislative days. And I've heard of no bill that seems available that they could attach it to. So you're talking 30 legislative days. And then once the petition is submitted, it requires another 7-day waiting period before it can be voted on. Then the speaker has to bring it up within 2 days. That's how they can get around Johnson. But there's some talk, but it doesn't seem to be a strong move yet anyway. And as I mentioned, meanwhile, Ukraine is just running out of air defense missiles. Sometime this month is what the reports are. And Russia then will be able to carpet bomb Ukrainian cities like they did Mariupol, like they did Aleppo in Syria or Grozny in Chechnya, or like Israel has done to Gaza. That's what the Ukrainians are facing. Now, while it's not getting much attention, Biden actually has the authority now to send at least $4 billion worth of artillery shells and air defense missiles to Ukraine that they so desperately need. We'll put a few links in the chat about that, stories that appeared in reader-supported news, Forbes, and the New York Times. And that really struck me because the reader-supported news article said that members of Congress know this. So that may be one reason why the aid bill is being held up, because they say, well, Biden, you can send weapons now. And on the other hand, Biden may not want to send the weapons until that bill passes. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And meanwhile, Ukraine is lacking. And then you have to ask, you know, as the article in Reader Supported News does, you know, if he gets the aid, is he going to use it? We've seen, you know, this whole time, Biden has been reluctant to provide military aid to Ukraine. He was part of the Obama administration when they said we're not sending weapons after Russia seized Crimea and started a war in the Donbass. And then once the war started, you know, all we sent him, or it's about to start, all we sent him was less than 100 Javelin anti-tank missiles. And then when they, you know, successfully resisted Russia's assault on the capital, Kyiv, then they started sending military aid. But it took them until April to convene the 50 countries that are now in the coalition aiding Ukraine to meet at Ramstein, which it took a long time to get going. And then, you know, the Ukrainians wanted better artillery systems, the HIMARS systems. And first it was never, then it was maybe, and then finally it was. And the same thing with air defense systems. The Patriot systems didn't get there till April of last year, 2023, over a year, 15 months into the conflict. What if they'd had Patriot systems when Mariupol was being flattened? Would have been a whole different story. And then they delayed on tanks and finally gave them. And then they resisted fighter jets, the F-16s, and now they're training the pilots, but Ukraine still doesn't have them. And now they're hesitating on the longer range artillery systems that could, you know, strike deeper into Crimea and in the further reaches of, you know, behind the front lines on the Russian side. So Biden's commitment to Ukrainian self-determination is sketchy at best. And as I've mentioned here, at least the left in Ukraine understands that they've got a two-front struggle, not just against Russian tanks, but Western banks. And this whole neoliberal model of reconstruction and the austerity packages that the IMF is imposing on Ukraine to get loans so they can finance their government, is imposing Western economic imperialism. They got to fight that as well as Russian military imperialism. And there have been press reports, and they're usually anonymous sources. It's hard to know what the real truth is, but that the U.S. has already explored through back channels with Russia, basically forcing Ukraine to concede and accept a land for peace deal. And you've had establishment national security leaders like Henry Kissinger and Richard Haass advocating that. But you know what? Even though the U.S. is holding back support now, and if Trump gets elected, may just totally drop it, Europe is doubling down its support. I mean, they understand Russia is a, you know, is a close threat to them compared to us. And, you know, one commentator in Europe said, you know, we may face three authoritarian big powers soon, Russia, China, and the U.S., where the Trumpian far right is vetoing aid to Ukraine now and may soon recapture the presidency. So for us who want a consistent anti-imperialist approach, I suggest an article that Stephen Zunis had in Truth out this week called Getting Ukraine's History Right is Crucial for Anti-Imperialist Politics. And I think it's very good at knocking down some of the myths about the war in Ukraine that the Kremlin and its echo chambers in the West, both far right and what I call now the post left, are putting out there. And I also had an article that took off from Sergei Lavrov's statement that the military objectives of Ukraine, of Russia in Ukraine, are the same as Israel's in Gaza. And it's called Sergei Lavrov and Vulgar Anti-Imperialism. We'll put that in the chat too. So I said that, you know, the Gaza and Ukraine wars were the tip of the iceberg, and they are. Today, there are 183 conflicts going on in the world, according to the authoritative armed conflict survey published by the Institute for Strategic Studies in London. And that makes the world more conflict-ridden today than at any time since World War II, which includes the height of the Cold War and its proxy wars over the post-colonial status of the former colonies in the global South. And most of this violence comes from coups and civil wars, but the big powers are taking sides and intervening in them. In Sudan, a popular pro-democracy revolution of a few years ago has been sidetracked now into a civil war between military factions. And it's killed untold thousands and created nearly 8 million refugees in the last year. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a long-time civil war, still ongoing, has created 7 million refugees amid continued, repeated mass killing atrocities. In Yemen, the civil war left more than 250,000 dead and more than 20 million in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. And now it's being dragged back in, or dragged, it's putting itself back in. It's hard to, it's some of both, into the conflict between Israel and Gaza. In Ethiopia, there's now a truce, but there was a civil war in the Tigray province that killed as many as 600,000 people over the last 2 years. In the Central African Republic, the civil war killed 6% of the total population in 2022 alone. We saw Azerbaijan seize Nagorno-Karabakh region, which has been Armenian for 2,500 years, and ethnically cleansed it of the over 100,000 Armenians in that region. Morocco still violently occupies Western Sahara with U.S. backing. In fact, only Israel and the U.S. Recognize Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara, which wants independence. Same thing with Indonesia, which still violently occupies West Papua, where there's been an insurgency going on since the early 60s, when, you know, the West Papuans wanted independence when the Dutch left, but Indonesia seized it. And it's as many atrocities there as we saw in East Timor before it gained its independence from Indonesia. India violently occupying Kashmir. Turkey and Syria are competing to occupy the Kurdish lands in northern Syria. In Myanmar or Burma, the military junta that overthrew the elected government in 2021 is in a civil war against pro-democracy and ethnic minority forces. And we have in many countries, Islamic jihadists are still conducting terrorist wars across Eurasia, the Middle East, and Africa. We got drug mafias ruling many regions of Central and South America. In Africa, Sahel, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Red Sea, six countries have had 11 coup attempts, eight of them successful, just since 2020. And in that case, both the U.S. through AFRICOM and Russia through its state-sanctioned Wagner Group are engaged in military operations in many of those countries in support of their favored client governments, which are generally authoritarian. So we're in a world where aggressive authoritarian states, notably Russia, Israel, China, Iran, India, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, I could explain how all they're involved in, you know, foreign military operations and supporting proxies, but they are busting up the liberal international law tradition that came out of World War II that is embodied in the UN Charter and the UN Declaration of Human Rights and is, you know, strictly proscribes seizing territories, occupying countries, but it's being practiced. And the United States pays homage to that international order. They call it the rules-based order, but they violate it as much as these other countries do. What Russia and China are doing ideologically is asserting they're creating a new world order, what they call a multipolar world. But the kind of multipolar world they're putting forward rejects universal standards of human rights and democracy and international law, and basically says we can do what we want. We have our own standards. We can repress democratic rights, engage in aggressive wars of conquest, and because it's a multipolar world, we can, might makes right in our sphere of influence. And of course, Israel's doing the same thing with the Palestinians. So the multipolar world that they are promoting after US hegemony is a capitalist multipolarity of authoritarianism and imperialist spheres of influence that deny self-determination to dominated nations. And the world we want to replace US hegemony, the hegemony of US imperialism, is a socialist multipolarity based on human rights, democracy, and cooperation under international law. And as I said, the US hypothetically supports what they call the rules-based order, the UN Charter and international law and treaties, but they violate those rules with massive military operations all around the world. And it's most obvious now in their unconditional support for Israeli apartheid occupation and now genocide in Gaza. And what that makes the US is it's probably more effective than Russia and China in undermining this liberal international order that was based on making aggression a crime and upholding people's right to self-determination and the democratic and social standards in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And the US is being more effective at it because nobody in the world takes the US seriously anymore when it speaks up for human rights and democracy and international law because it violates those standards so often in practice. And so that's why I say the US is as effective or more effective than Russia and China in undermining international law that upholds human rights and the right to self-determination. And all this conflict is only going to get worse due to climate change and the struggles over water, arable land, and other economic resources that climate-induced scarcities will provide. So, you know, that's a pretty miserable picture. So, you know, what should we as Greens be doing and advocating? And I think it comes back to the Global Green New Deal we've been talking about, and real peace policies that we demand of the U.S. government. The Global Green New Deal, part of it is meeting people's basic material needs, providing economic security that reduces conflicts over resources. It provides a material basis for human rights, democracy, and international law, and a material basis for democratic and economic opportunities that are alternatives to the religious and ethno-nationalist extremism that fills in where for progressive forces in many of these countries who have failed with the support of the U.S., opposing nationalist, secular, socialist movements as a threat to their to U.S.-based multinational corporations and the global capitalist system. It also provides a material basis of economic opportunity and alternative to the drug mafias that are influential and devastating in South and Central America, but also in the Middle East. I mean, Syria right now is the, you know, providing this Captagon, which is kind of a meth throughout the Middle East. It's creating all kinds of havoc. It's the biggest export that Syria has right now, and it's state sponsored. So it's not just in South and Central America where there are drug mafias. So doing this global Green New Deal would make the U.S. the world's humanitarian superpower. We would be making friends instead of enemies and building a material basis for peace instead of what we do now, which is using the military to support the exploitation of the world's people and resources by U.S.-based multinational corporations. So global Green New Deal is one thing, and then we need real peace policies. We need to start bringing U.S. troops home and reduce the threat that other nations feel by being having the U.S. military forwardly based in over 800 foreign military bases. There should be an orderly withdrawal from those from that forward deployment in those bases. And the U.S. should make the transition to a home-based defensive defense. And, you know, there may be occasions when U.S. troops should go abroad for multinational deterrence and peacekeeping missions and maybe support people who are facing aggression in their wars of defense. But that is not what we're doing with our military these days, except for maybe the arms we're providing to Ukraine reluctantly and slowly. And then we need peace conversion. This used to be a big topic, particularly, you know, after the Soviet Union fell apart, but it was something that the peace movement put forward as part of its program throughout the Vietnam War period and the anti-nuclear weapons period in the late 70s and 80s. And so the U.S. should stop being the world's largest arms producer and supplier. The U.S. now accounts for 40% of the world's arms transfers, and convert military production and personnel from factory workers and soldiers to engineers and managers to green civilian production. In other words, the Green New Deal. And that's the part of the Green New Deal that the Green Party has advocated. Deep cuts to military spending to help fund the Green New Deal, and also put those human as well as physical resources into the Green New Deal. That was dropped by the Democrats, you know, AOC and Senator Markey in their non-binding resolution for a Green New Deal. It mentioned military spending, among other things they left out of what the Greens have been talking about. So peace conversion, and then we really got to demand nuclear disarmament initiatives. We're into a new nuclear arms race. All the old arms control treaties with the, which were with the Soviet Union, now the Russian Federation, have been withdrawn from, mostly by the U.S., some by the USSR, or by the Russian Federation. The latest is the new START treaty that Putin says he's not going to talk about with the West until some of his demands are met. So what we should be demanding, like Daniel Ellsberg advocated in his last book, The Doomsday Machine, and many other forums and articles, dismantle our intercontinental ballistic missiles, the land-based nuclear missiles, and the nuclear-armed strategic bombers. The land-based missiles are just make us a target. They're not needed for deterrence. And the strategic bombers are also obsolete. And the air bases where they're based make us targets as well. The submarine-launched ballistic missiles are sufficient for deterrence. And we should reduce to a minimum credible deterrence. And with those nuclear disarmament initiatives, go to the other nuclear powers and say, look, we've changed our policy. It's time for a complete and general nuclear disarmament and get into the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which so many non-nuclear countries are now a part of, and none of the nuclear countries are. I mean, this is where the U.S. becoming the humanitarian superpower, peacemaker instead of war maker, could make a big difference and put the other nuclear powers at least pressure them under world public opinion that, you know, if the U.S. is now willing to disarm, why aren't you? And I think we can create a dynamic that moves us toward nuclear disarmament and away from, you know, the situation we are now where the bullets in the atomic scientists has their nuclear or their doomsday clock, the closest it's ever been to midnight. So these are the policies I believe we should be demanding in the streets and on the ballot. And, you know, there's such radical changes from U.S. capitalist imperialism that the corporate-sponsored Democrats and Republicans support, that they're never going to implement it. And that's why we need a serious Green Party that's about power, not just posturing. We really got to get serious about getting our people elected all across the country, local, and on that basis, state, and then Congress. And we need to do it fast, because the climate crisis isn't waiting, and these wars all threaten to escalate into a nuclear confrontation. So I'll stop there, and let's have questions and comments. Amy L. Sachs, I'd still like to know when the Dems will acknowledge the hand their precious Clintons had in paving the way for Putin, all the while they screech at Stein, soulless hypocrites. Yeah, for people that are not familiar with that, when Yeltsin, he was in the single digits in polls when his reelection came up, I think it was 1996. And so Clinton got, you know, the U.S. really controls the International Monetary Fund, got a big loan to the Russian Federation so Yeltsin could, you know, get the economy up and running and get a lot of goodies handed out. And then Clinton sent what they call in Eastern Europe political technologists. We call them campaign consultants. You know, some of the top people in this country, including one guy whose name I'm remembering, Dick somebody, who was a advisor to Clinton. Now he's a Fox News host. But he went over there and you know, they engineered really a miraculous recovery. So Yeltsin was reelected. And what did Yeltsin do? Well, he was corrupt as could be. And when he wanted to hand off power, he wanted someone who would promise not to prosecute him and his family for the bribery and embezzlement they had been engaged in. As you know, the Soviet Union dissolved, and they had shock therapy to turn them into a neoliberal capitalist kind of economy. And it happened so fast, it really destroyed the living standards of the Russian and the Soviet people. And so Yeltsin wanted, and Yeltsin had his hand in the, you know, the cookie jar too. So he wanted somebody to promise that he would not be, and his family would not be prosecuted for those crimes. And he appointed, and Putin was the guy who would do that. And that's how Putin came to power the last day of 1999. And then won the election quickly thereafter. You know, Yeltsin resigned and Putin took his place. So, and then Clinton is, you know, complaining about Putin, you know, meddling in the 2016 election. But she needs to look in the mirror, because she's had a role in putting Putin in power in the first place. And of course, the Democrats do not have internal introspection that the public can see, even if they have it internally, which I doubt many of them do, because I guess you could, you know, you can't find a democratic political culture and discussion influencing the leadership of the Democratic Party. That mostly takes place in the liberal media. And even there's not much acknowledgement of the role that the Clintons had in paving the way for Putin. I guess it's an example of karma. What goes around comes around. And us having a role in putting Putin in power, and he came back and bit us. Ashley R., Ray Hypocrisy, Pot Meat Kettle. How is Jill's recent Rumble Fest with OAN moderator representative of leftism in any way? Oh, alt-right. That, quote, debate was Harlan Crow's dinner for schmucks. Okay, I kind of know what you're, the kind of thing you're talking about. I don't know the specific thing that Jill participated in. And I don't know if you're talking about the free and equal debate the other night, and the moderator came from OAN. That may be true. I haven't seen that debate yet. I plan to look at it tonight. But I will say that I think Jill's a bit credulous with some of the people she is willing to give a platform to by going on their programs. For example, Jimmy Dore, although I believe now she's not going back on him after he, you know, as he does, you know, took gratuitous swipes at her. In this case, what was it? Oh, had to do with Peter Dow and, you know, Peter Dow supposedly being a Democratic plant in first the West campaign and then the Jill Stein campaign. And, you know, Jimmy Dore just pulls these conspiracies out his ass. And Jill, you know, I think is not going back on Jimmy Dore, whereas before she would. So I don't know the specific reference you're having, but let me put it this way. If I was in Jill's place, and I learned a lot in 2020 about this, their platforms I won't go on because I'm giving them a platform. And a lot of these people are, they're basically, and Cornel West made this point on Breonna Joy Gray's podcast the other day about Jimmy Dore and the wannabes at the Revolutionary Blackout Network. Their shtick is to create controversies so they get eyeballs and donations to their websites. That's how they make their money. So it's not a very good forum to have a real discussion. And so I would, I have stopped going on a lot of those platforms. I mean, the first one I rejected was Press TV from Iran. This goes back to when I ran for U.S. Senate in 2006. And I didn't really know much about them. I figured, okay, I can talk to Iranians. But the reporters, so-called, who were interviewing me had questions that were so leading. They were like push polls. And then I realized, you know, what it's a very propagandistic outlet. And I did go on RT early in the 2020 campaign because, you know, the role it played in 2016, it was one of the few outlets where, you know, Jill Stein could get heard. And so I figured the same. But having gone on them a number of times, you know, I realized that they don't want me to hear what I have to say. They want to use me as a prop. So, and you got to see that. And then they're the wannabes or the echo chamber here in the U.S. You know, I mentioned them earlier. They're on the far right. That's pretty clear to see. But there's some that pose as progressives, but are really what some people call the post-left. They have progressive, you know, aesthetics and verbiage, but content is to the right. Like Jimmy Dore. I mean, he had damn that Jones guy from the guy that denied, you know, said the children killed in some of these school shootings were crisis actors. His last name is Jones. I'm forgetting his first name. Alex Jones. Yeah. How could I forget? Well, I guess it's because I don't want to remember him. Yeah, he had Alex Jones on as a guest. He's had, you know, Boogaloo Boys, who is a, you know, from a far right movement. And even claimed that, see, they're like us. But, you know, he had his fight with Cornel West, telling Cornel to stop talking about, you know, white supremacy and black liberation. People don't want to hear that. White people maybe don't want to hear. That's what Jimmy Dore was saying. So anyway, I get the point of your question, and I agree that, you know, people like Jill or, you know, our presidential candidate should be, you know, selective as to who they give a platform to, because it's not just the host of a show giving the platform to you. You're giving a platform to them. You're giving your stamp of approval that they're worth talking to. And some of them definitely are not. Cole McMullen, Howie, what are your hopes, fears, and predictions for the American left going into the 2024 election and beyond? Well, let's start with hopes. I hope we get a larger vote than we've been getting for Jill Stein and the Green Party. There's a possibility of that given the, you know, how many people are alienated by Biden, particularly for his actions in Gaza. You know, it's not... is Gilbert Achkar, who's a Lebanese commentator, academic, who's, you know, followed what's going on in the Middle East for a long time, and said this is the first Israeli war that's really a joint U.S.-Israeli war, because we're so tied to the hip to them with the weapons. So Biden is, you know, pushing people away from him. So my hope is, you know, that translates into a lot of votes for Jill. My fear is that Trump's going to come back in. You know, as bad as Biden is, Trump is worse. He's an autocrat, has no respect for democracy. You know, and the things, if you read that Heritage Foundation paper that, you know, projects what they want to do, you know, basic democratic rights are on the chopping block if Biden comes in. And my predictions. Well, my prediction is, it's hard to predict this year. Let me say that. But I think Biden's going to squeak by because Trump is so bad. And unfortunately for the Greens, a lot of people are going to hold their nose and vote for Biden to stop Trump. So that's my prediction. Now, you know, for the left, you know, what will strengthen us is the stronger the vote Jill Stein gets. It tells us, ourselves, and the public that there's a large sentiment in favor of the things we stand for, like Medicare for All and a Green New Deal and peace policies. But, you know, and my hope, you know, beyond 2024 is that the Greens will get serious, more serious, about organizing strong locals and contesting for power. I mean, we sort of have, and it's true on the whole left, kind of this, you know, Quaker witness thing where, you know, we're gonna speak truth to power, but we're not gonna go after the power. We need power. That's, you know, that's what we want if we're gonna make these changes, because they're not gonna be made by the Democrats or Republicans. So my hope is that beyond 2024, we focus on two things: getting a hell of a lot more Greens elected to local office as a foundation for state office in the House. And then we keep making progress on ranked choice voting, and particularly proportional ranked choice voting, to get proportional representation in city councils, state legislatures, and the House of Representatives. I think those are the two things that I hope we'll be doing. I hope we're starting to do it now and carry on beyond the 2024 election. See, Imani, I think we're past Biden versus Trump. It no longer matters who's worse if they're both leading us off a cliff. We need to break free to save ourselves. I agree, but I don't think we can equate Biden and Trump. I agree we're headed off a cliff. But Trump is worse than Biden. I mean, you know, it's just, I think, objectively true. And then, you know, look at it another way. We will have more success with our demands with Biden and the Democrats in charge than with Trump and these neo-fascist Republicans in charge. The Democrats at least have to worry that we'll be taking votes from them. That's why we got to keep running Greens, independent. They got to compete for the vote of progressives. That puts pressure on them. It doesn't matter to the Republicans. So the conditions after the election, we will be able to be more successful in, you know, raising demands and getting some response if it's Biden and the Democrats than if it's Trump and the Republicans. On the other hand, the fundamental changes we need, and they're not that, you know, radical, like, you know, universal public health care. You know, most countries have that. And we can't even get it discussed by the Democratic Party, let alone the Republican Party. So that's why we need an alternative. It needs to be built now. And I'll say another thing, you know, in most states, there's only 4 to 7 states that are going to be really contested for the presidential election. That means the other, you know, 40, let's see, counting DC, it's 44 to 47 states where we already know who's going to win. It's a red state that Biden will win, or a red state that Trump will win, or a blue state that Biden will win. In those states, you know, people can vote for the Greens and not worry that it's going to affect the outcome. I think the odds that people who vote for Stein, who would have voted for Biden, they tend to be small. We know from the 2016 exit poll that 61% of Stein voters would have stayed home. Only 25% would have voted for Clinton, if this is if she's not on the ballot, and 14% for Trump. And you put those numbers into Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, Trump still would have won. So I think the odds of Stein spoiling the election are real, but they're pretty small. So, you know, my advice to people is, you know, as I was saying in 2020, vote for what you want. If you don't vote for what you want, you're not going to get it. And if you vote for Biden and you want Medicare for all or a Green New Deal, he's opposed to those things. And your vote gets lost in the sauce. Nobody knows you're for Medicare for all or the Green New Deal. If it's a green vote, they know. So, you know, your vote is your voice and you need to use it. So anyway, you were headed for a cliff, that's right. But there is a difference between Trump and Biden. I think we have to acknowledge that. And if we don't acknowledge that when we're speaking to the public, they're going to look at us like we don't even know what we're talking about. Everybody can see that difference. So I think we have to acknowledge that. And BD Dimmitt, we're looking at zero chance either with either party in place. Zero chance of, I assume, progressive changes. Even when Biden ran on promises that were right in line with our positions, he won and did the exact opposite. Yeah, I just wrote a fundraising letter for Jill Stein where I pointed out the top legislative priority of the Democrats when Biden came in and they had both houses of Congress was H.R. 1, the omnibus election reform bill that included restoring the Voting Rights Act. And it didn't pass because Biden wouldn't take on and the Democratic leadership wouldn't take on the filibuster in the Senate, which has been how right-wing minorities have blocked civil rights and other progressive legislation for over a century. So when they had the power, they didn't use it. For something as basic, it's not radical, it's just, you know, liberal democracy. The Voting Rights Act, getting it restored. I guess my other example was how Biden, you know, he always wants to do bipartisan compromise with the party that tried to overthrow him, the Republicans, and he just did it again with this, border legislation where he conceded most of the very reactionary measures that the Republicans want regarding immigration. So by doing that, the Democrats are reinforcing the xenophobic Republican narrative that says, oh, there's a invasion of aliens at the border that's threatening our national security. That's nonsense. These are poor people that are looking for better opportunities or, you know, protection from political repression. These people will do jobs that most native-born Americans won't, in agriculture, meatpacking plants, home health aides, those kinds of things. They contribute to the economy. They create as many jobs as they take because they're expanding the economy. They are not the economic threat. They're not the security threat. They are bringing the drugs in. Most of them are driven in by drug smugglers, not poor people trying to get into the United States. So to reinforce that whole narrative, that's what the Democrats are doing. So, you know, I agree with you, Beatty. It's, there's zero chance of getting, you know, many of our, you know, very progressive reforms passed. That I agree with. Although I will reassert that we have a better chance of pushing them and getting something progressive, at least in that direction, from the Democrats, because they have to listen to us, particularly, and this is where the people that say, you got to vote for Biden, a vote for Jill Stein, a vote for Trump, where they get it wrong. Because if the Democrats are forced to compete for progressive votes, they're going to keep moving to the right, chasing the Republicans to the right. So I'll leave it at that. Beatty, Dimmitt, piperize the GOP to the right, then meet them halfway, repeat into fascism. Yeah, that's the logic. And that's the logic of lesser evilism. I mean, we should have learned this when Hitler came to power. The Social Democratic Party in Germany decided rather than run their own candidate or form a coalition with the communists for a united left candidate, although the communists wouldn't do that either for their own reasons. You know, the communists were saying after Hitler, us, because Hitler was so bad. It's like Clinton saying she wanted to run against Trump and encouraging the media to promote Trump. But what happened was the Social Democrats said, well, we're going to support von Hindenburg as a lesser evil to Hitler and to stop Hitler. And what did von Hindenburg, who was a, you know, militarist, conservative, aristocratic right winger, But he wasn't as far right as Hitler, so they supported von Hindenburg. And what did he do? He appointed Hitler chancellor. And he thought, well, that'll make Hitler have to be responsible and it'll tone him down. And of course, Hitler did the exact opposite. And pretty soon, you know, there were no alternative parties in Germany and he was the dictator. So that's what happens. The lesser evil just leads you further to, you know, more, even more evil things. Emil Sachs, hope we will talk about the no confidence vote in Michigan. Just saw that in my email. Dems don't care if they win the presidency. Hence, cleaving of the leadership to Biden. Yeah, vote for the uncommitted delegates. You know, they have in primary elections, it's a tradition in the Democratic and Republican parties, should be in the Green Party too, but you have a slate of candidates that are uncommitted because they want to keep their options open at the convention in case, you know, nobody arrives with the majority of delegates and, you know, gets the ballot on the first round. And it hasn't been used very much. It used to be a lot of people would go as uncommitted because the conventions were brokered. They had real debate and horse trading at the convention. But since, you know, really the Democratic convention in 1968 was really the last one where that happened. But they still have uncommitted slates. So in Michigan, the people demanding a ceasefire in demanding that Trump, that Biden get behind a ceasefire in Gaza, said they were voting uncommitted. And now I know that Jason Call, who is Jill Stein's campaign manager, lives in Washington State. He posted a picture of his ballot. He voted uncommitted in Washington State. And now there are organized efforts, I believe, in Minnesota and Washington State, and it sounds like it's spreading. So that's a way for people who are in the Democratic Party or, I guess even where they have top two or top four elections, they still have party primaries for president. So if you get a Democratic ballot or have access to one, some states are open primaries. And if your state's not having a green primary, you can ask for the Democratic ballot and vote uncommitted to send Biden a message. I think something is an option for people to, you know, use their vote as their voice on the question of Gaza and you know, put a little pressure on Biden to get behind a ceasefire and the other demands that the, you know, solidarity with Palestinian movement is putting forward. Cole McCullen, how, any thoughts regarding the news that the Teamsters donated $45,000 to the RNC? Yeah, it pisses me off as a retired Teamster. And, you know, we got a reform slate in, but they're not all that progressive. They said they were going to talk to all the presidential candidates. And in the first round, they did have Cornel West and Robert Kennedy, but not Jill Stein. You know, I wrote to him at the time, you know, as a retired Teamster, as a former Green presidential candidate, saying, you know, our ticket in 2020 was a truck driver and a warehouse worker, Angela Walker and me, and I was a Teamster. So you really should have the Greens there. And, you know, Jill Stein's platform is more pro-worker than any of the candidates that they could talk to. Never heard back from them. I think they've since met with Trump, but not Jill Stein. You know, it's pissing me off. And there's an article that somebody's drafting that I saw a first draft of suggesting that, there was an article in Counterpunch by Tom Leadham, who ran against Hoffa back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Sylvester, the president of Local 804 in New York City, big local that was Ron Kerry's home base. Ron Kerry was the Teamster president that led the big strike in 1996, or was it seven? And another guy whose name is skipping my mind at the point, but there are three veteran Teamsters, all of them having 40 or more years in the Teamsters. And they were saying that the new leadership of the Teamsters has got to listen to the rank and file, got to open it up. They're also criticizing Teamsters for Democratic Union for being so much behind the O'Brien leadership now in the Teamsters. So, you know, my thoughts are that we got Hoffa out, but we got Hoffa-like people back in. Maybe not as bad as Hoffa yet anyway, but they're not the kind of progressive labor leaders that we need. So that's something that's being talked about within the Teamster movement in Teamster circles. And, you know, it may lead to a challenge to O'Brien in the next presidential election. There's a lot of irritation, you know, particularly people that, you know, thought that we could have got more. We got a much better contract. It was not concessionary like the Hoffa contracts for the last 20 years. But we could have got more, particularly getting rid of the two tiers between part-time and full-time workers and the difference in pay and, you know, the hours you can work. And we could have done that by going on strike and by the rank and file being out there and feeling their power would have made the Teamsters much more powerful movement with the rank and file more engaged. And O'Brien, you know, cut a deal that headed off the strike, short of the full demands that the Teamsters put forward. So there's criticism of that. But, you know, donating to the RNC, the Republican National Committee, that's old school politics where you give money to both parties so you have, you know, a foot in the door and they'll listen to you. I mean, the Republicans couldn't care less about the Teamsters and organized labor, except when it comes time to getting votes. And they'll try to get those votes by focusing on cultural issues, not labor, economic issues. So that's a waste of money. But I think it's a waste of money to give it to the Democrats as well, because, you know, they say thank you very much and take it for granted. Like labor law reform, you know, Obama said he would do it, the card check union recognition when he was first elected in 2008. And he didn't do it when he had the majority in both houses, the first session or you know, Congress that was during his administration. So he told the labor movement, including the Teamsters, well, we'll do it after we get reelected in 2012. And actually the Teamsters, you know, contacted Obama and said, well, you promised, now it's after the election, you won. Are we going to get this labor law reform passed? And the Obama administration basically said, later for you, you know, we got reelected, thank you, but we got other priorities. So that's what you get for giving away your money and your endorsements to the Democrats without getting, you know, real commitments or reminding them of the promises they broke in the past. So those are some of my thoughts about the Teamsters and the donation to the Republican National Convention is pretty low. Okay, an hour has passed, and there's so much to talk about. We'll be here next Saturday, 3:00. I don't have a guest scheduled, but I might have one. I'm talking to a couple people this week, so stay tuned for that. And, you know, please get out there for these pro-Palestinian demonstrations. We need a ceasefire now. It's, you know, it's genocide. There's no other way to describe what the Israelis are doing in Gaza. And that's probably the most urgent thing before us, but there's a lot of urgent things. So, you know, everybody keep plugging away, realize that we have more power than it seems apparent at times, and it makes a difference. And otherwise, have a good week, and we'll see you next week. We got power, love.